I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Technology has given birth to a new place, according to my first guest. Dalton Connolly is the author of the book Elsewhere USA, and in it he describes the way the American social landscape has changed from the 1950s ideal of a split between work and home to a constantly connected 24-hour economy. He'll tell us what it means to combine work with leisure and investment with consumption. And we'll speak with John Norquist of the Congress for the New Urbanism. He'll tell us about trends that are shaping urban development worldwide and how the way our streets are laid out affects our daily lives. All that plus the news from Planet Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith on today's Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. What else are you doing while you're listening to this show? Are you checking your first email, driving to work, fixing lunch? You might call it multitasking, but my first guest, Dalton Connolly, says it's part of the subtle erosion of the boundary between work and leisure. Dalton is a sociologist, a professor at New York University, and the author of many books, his latest being Elsewhere USA. Dalton, where is Elsewhere?
Elsewhere is really a state of mind or a lifestyle more than a particular place, as inherent in the name. Elsewhere is the act or the state of being simultaneously connected to somewhere else while you're physically co-located with other people you're supposedly interacting with. Your attention is split between the here and the there and the elsewhere. Sometimes it can even occur if you're not really connected via BlackBerry or iPhone or a laptop or what have you. It can happen just because we're so harried and we know that we have something else to attend to somewhere else as well, and therefore it splits our attention or our minds.
In your book, Elsewhere USA, you write, work is now the central aspect of our lives. Is there something new about that?
To a certain extent, work being the central aspect of our lives is new, and a certain extent, it's the same old story. The issue is really that the 1950s, for many of us, even if we weren't alive then, have become the implicit cultural reference point, the kind of leave it to beaver lifestyle of the nuclear family that's newly suburbanized and so forth. And that was a very particular moment in U.S. history when work hours were steadily declining because of post-war economic vibrancy and increased efficiency. And in fact, Presidential Blue Ribbon Commission worried about what would we do with all our leisure time? How would we still make meaning in life without work, just playing bridge and pinochle and golf all day long, I guess. Of course, little do they know that they didn't have anything to worry about, because basically from about the early 60s onward, work hours started steadily climbing again. And in particular, the difference this time was that they climbed steeply for high-income workers and not so much for low-income workers, so that for the first time, the further up the income ladder you go, the more hours you work. It used to be that it was the grunts at the bottom who worked more hours, and the execs were kicking off for golf, but now it's the other way around. Of course, the work that the executives do, you could argue, is much easier, less stressful. So in a way, we're really returning to how things were 100 years ago, where life was constant work, and to our cultural roots, which is really Calvinism, the Protestant ethic of work is key to salvation, and work is the central aspect of our lives. So that really was buried underneath our culture for the most of the mid-century, but now it's returned with a vengeance.
Even before this recession, you pointed out that we had become more anxious about our economic status. Why?
I think when times are good, we become anxious in relative terms, that incomes are increasing, particularly at the top. But the catch is that the further up the income ladder you go, the bigger the gaps get. So you can never keep up, because there's always somebody that's pulling away from you as you're pulling away from the people below you. So that's good times. And so even if we're doing better in absolute terms, we're not doing better in relative terms as we move up the ladder. It's kind of like going up the down escalator. In times like now, in downturns, our anxiety shifts to our absolute status. We just want to hold on to what we've got, that overpriced house that we're really overextended for in our mortgage payments, or our job, or our 401k, or what have you. our kids' college savings fund. This is our worries now. They take on a different flavor, but we're no less anxious in either good or bad times, I would argue.
Well, when you wrote Elsewhere USA, you called it phantom anxiety. Now it appears that our anxiety was justified. Since we have become so attached to work, what happens when work disappears? What happens to an individual when work disappears, when you have felt, you know, your whole life was about being connected and always on?
I think that the phantom anxiety that people felt during the good times was, yes, justified, because it turned out that all that money that was being created hand over fist wasn't real wealth that was being created through long-term infrastructure or other kinds of real investments in our society. And now that's all come crashing down. I think in a bizarre way, it's almost as if the, you know, the other shoe has fallen, and people can feel a sense of relief that this is not personally but societally. It was too good to be true. And yes, in fact, it was too good to be true. Those housing values that seemed like they were never going to stop rising, in the stock market and so forth. So now when people are losing their jobs, we have to keep in mind that what I'm writing about is really a condition or a state of mind or a state of society that really only applies to the upper group in America. I mean, you could debate where that to draw that line, but it's the rise in inequality has only occurred in the top half, and it really occurred the further up you go in the ladder. So the irony of all this, of course, is even though it's the investment bankers losing their jobs that's getting a lot of attention, because they're the ones who read the New York Times and want to read about themselves, they're going to do just fine in the end. It's the folks that depend on them for their livelihood, you know, everything from the nanny to the local shopkeeper whose business is fueled by the so-called masters of the universe, who are no longer masters of the universe, who have their wealth trickle down. So like in any other time, this is not unique. It's going to be the people who are the least, have the least resources, the most vulnerable, that actually pay the ultimate price with their jobs and their life savings and so forth. I think the rich people are going to lose a lot of money in numbers, a couple zeros, but they're going to end up being just fine in the end.
Mm-hmm. Rereading your book for this interview, Dalton, I was struck by how much of this current crisis you foreshadowed, maybe unintentionally. But for instance, you wrote, this constant fear of being exposed, cut out, or outsourced, and thereby having one's capital rendered valueless, is the principal pathos of the era. Many skilled, accomplished executives fear they're not good enough, imposters about to be found out. Do you believe there was some general shared feeling that some of what we were seeing was not real and not sustainable, even, you know, even in our own lives, in our own work, in our own experience?
Definitely. I think that there's evidence, for example, that as far back as 2005, one of the most popular articles in the Harvard Business Review was about fraud anxiety and why you should not succumb to fraud anxiety. I think that the shock and the protest that we're seeing from the executive suite right now about the rage that the rest of America is feeling about their compensation is a little disingenuous. They knew all along, deep inside their hearts and on Wall Street, that they were trying to make something out of nothing, spinning, you know, gold out of straw, and that the piper would come for his payment at some point. So I think that in the book, I tried to make no predictions. I didn't anticipate how fast this would all crash, but definitely the seeds of this kind of castle in the sky were recognized by everybody.
Your observations about social capital are interesting. You write that social capital is real capital in an information economy. Explain what you mean.
I mean that where in a service economy, in a knowledge economy, where relationships are everything, where the next big idea may come to fruition from a chance meeting between a venture capitalist and a young software engineer, or the next jingle that's going to be the multimillion-dollar ad campaign comes from the four-year-old making up a sentence in a sandbox. I think that those who control the social valves and can link venture capitalists with the young, brilliant software engineer just out of college or so forth, that becomes real value, real source of informational arbitrage that can be profited from, just like the spice merchants linked the East and the West in the year 1200, and just the way that any trader, any entrepreneur makes their profits.
You visited Google headquarters. I've been there too. What did you find there that was emblematic of our approach to work?
When I got to Google, I was first and foremost stunned by how playful it was. Should have guessed that, I suppose, by its name. It would be very difficult to imagine General Standard Search Engines Incorporated, or, you know, U.S. search engines, the way that, you know, U.S. Steel or General Standard were major corporations in a bygone era. Today, corporate life is playful. We have Google and Yahoo as two of the biggest companies, and Flickster and so forth. This new economy merges business and play, and you can see that on the Googleplex, as they call their campus, their corporate headquarters, in that, first of all food is free. It's very good, too. And to work off those extra calories that you might be consuming, there's a gym on site, there's volleyball courts, there's games everywhere, there's even on-call massage therapists. They make it so nice. They take care of your laundry. You can get a haircut. Your dry cleaning is done there. They make it so nice in that regard that you don't ever want to leave. And though it's an expensive HR strategy at first, clearly getting your software programmers to stay and work an extra couple hours, even though they're not paid by the hour, is well worth the dry cleaning expenses that it might cost you, or the free food as a corporate entity. So even though I was stunned at first and stuffed my face the first day and suffered indigestion, it was from the free food. It quickly dawned on me that this was actually a brilliant marketing strategy, and there's a reason why Google's consistently rated as one of the best places to work, even though the prevailing wages there are lower than the competitors.
Well, most of us don't work at Google. What advice would you give an urban leader about making his or her city as sticky as Google is as a company? Are there lessons that you think Google has to teach an urban leader about how to make the city a more appealing and a place that where people stick?
Definitely. If you want to attract the best talent in your private sector or in your public sector as a municipal leader, I would say that what you need to do is learn to blend and bend. In other words, there is no point in our society today, in our economy, in the knowledge economy in particular, that you need folks to show up and sit at a cubicle and do their work in a situation where they really don't need face-to-face interaction. The more that you can allow flex time and integrate work and home, make the office more like home and make the home more like the office, the more you're going to get out of workers and the more productivity and efficiency and to a certain extent quality of life you're going to get for residents in your area, and you're going to be able to attract the best talent. That means perhaps having on-site daycare so that parents can interact with their kids throughout the course of a day and not have these artificial old-school boundaries between home and work or between unpaid child labor and paid work in the marketplace. You'll be able to attract better talent if you recognize that today 70% of moms work outside the home. As recently as 1975, at the height of the feminist movement, only a third of mothers did. In the 50s, only 17% of mothers did. But now, not only do 70% work outside the home, but those 70% are disproportionately the upper income professionals, the kinds that most cities and CEOs want to attract. So universities have long had spousal hiring policies. I think that more and more other firms that might not have had them always might think about how do we employ an entire family, because these boundaries between the breadwinner and the non-breadwinner and so forth no longer hold fast in our economy.
And as you talk about that, I think those strategies are completely applicable to businesses or to a city government, for instance. But if you push outside the boundaries of an organization, push outside the boundaries of City Hall and think about the city as an entity, many, many people, for instance, are workers who've used Starbucks as their office, if you will. So in that case, are there things that you can imagine that you could push out into the public realm that would make a city, again, a place where that would attract the best talent?
Oh, definitely. You put your finger on it when you talked about these third spaces that people have increasingly used. They're neither home nor office, but some other venue where people want to be alone together, so to speak, where they want to work on their laptops or make business calls on their cell phones, but they don't want to do it from home. They want to do it from a cafe or from a park. So I would add in the importance of public parks and playgrounds for children, because to the extent that I can, on a nice day, take care of my kids when there's happens to be some school holiday or curriculum day or half day because of parent-teacher meetings or the numerous days off that they have off that I don't have off, it's great when I can take them to a playground that they enjoy and I can be productive at the same time and kind of check in on them once in a while, but also get my wireless work done because there's municipal Wi-Fi like they're trying to do in Philadelphia and Detroit, for example, and some other cities, like when there's also good, obviously, cell phone reception. But the most important thing is the fact that there is a public space where kids can interact with other kids and parents can be there and play these two roles at the same time. The more cities create those kind of spaces, and I'm not an urban planner, so my imagination can only think of public parks and perhaps public cafes as opposed to Starbucks. I know that's only the tip of the iceberg when you get real talented architects and urban planners thinking about these issues of blending work and home.
You, of course, write about our distractions, our being both connected to the people who are sitting in front of us, but at the same time connected through the BlackBerry, through the iPhone, through the computer, to other places and other people. And of course, you and I both see people walk down the street with, you know, they've got their earphones plugged in, and you wonder, do they know what city they're in? Do they know what corner they're on? Are they paying any attention to the real world that they're in versus the world that they're being transported to through the device? And I'm wondering if you think there are things that urban leaders can do or should do to make the place, the real place, more compelling.
That's a tough question. I do lament the fact that public space is increasingly populated by zombies walking around on their earbuds or their cell phone conversations, and that there doesn't seem to be any physical interaction with the people we're co-located with. But I'm not sure that there's anything that urban leaders can do about that. I suppose the best thing people can do is make it attractive for folks to turn off their iPods or their iPhones and pay attention to what's going on around them. And the best way to do that is through creating a great local environment.
Mm-hmm. In your author's note in the book, you did something I thought that was very unusual. You asked the reader, do I make sense? Did you get any response from readers to that question?
I think that particular question really got me in a bunch of trouble with readers, because the answer was sometimes. You know, some of what I wrote about struck people as spot on, and some of it didn't apply to them and seemed a bit foreign. And by asking that, I think I created the false expectation or criterion that either all makes sense to you or none of it does. And the answer is, of course, pieces do, and so everyone has their own identifications with the book and not with other parts.
Let's go back to the question of what now. With the economy tanking, what is the next logical iteration of Elsewhere USA?
Well, one possible effect of the economy tanking is the fact that of the trends I've talked about in the book as driving the kind of texture of life now, there's, of course, the technological changes with the wireless, weightless economy we now work in. There's the rising labor force participation of women, so that the kind of dynamics at home have completely changed. And then the third was rising inequality, and that every year since 1969, economic inequality has risen, and those rises have all taken place in the top half, at least through 2007. And really, 2008 and 2009 are a black box to me at this point. I could very much imagine that inequality is decreasing because of the paper losses on Wall Street and elsewhere. The last time that inequality, incidentally, was as high as it was in 2006 or 7 was 1929, right before the crash. So it's almost as if things get too top-heavy and they have to tip over. That said, I don't know. We don't have the data yet, so I don't know if that is fundamentally changed now. So I think what really we have a situation going forward where that force has been mitigated or modulated a bit, but the other two forces, women's work and the technological changes, have only accelerated or will accelerate. So what do you get when you put in two of those ingredients and not the third? I don't know the answer to that. We also have going forward a situation in which, like in all of history, any movement, in this case the kind of work all the time, constantly connected movement, creates its antithesis, creates its opposite in the form of a social movement. And we see the simple living, the slow foods movement, Michelle and Barack Obama digging up their own vegetable garden to try to eat locally and kind of take a step back from this crazy, all wired, all the time lifestyle and rediscover some things that we might have lost, supposedly. Now, also in history, what happens ultimately is a merger of these two things. So in the 50s, you had this this very conformist veneer to society, but you also had the seeds of the counterculture in the beatnik movement that led to the 60s counterculture and so forth, and the sexual revolution and all that. But ultimately, those two aspects of society merged. And that's best captured by David Brooks' very funny book, Bobos in Paradise. How is the slow foods, kind of simple living movement, back to the basics movement, going to combine with these kind of hyper-wired, always connected Facebook generation? I don't know, but I can't wait to see what it looks like, because it's going to look bizarre to us now, and they're going to look back on us with the same kind of quaint earnestness that we look on in the 50s.
Well, I can't wait to see either. Dalton, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks for having me.
The full title of Dalton Connolly's book is Elsewhere USA, How We Got From the Company Man, Family Dinners, and the Affluent Society to the Home Office, Blackberry Moms, and Economic Anxiety. We've got a link to the book on our website at smartcityradio.com. His interview was engineered by Amber Cortez. Now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of PlanEdison.
Until recently, the American dream was thriving on America's suburban fringes. These exurban areas far off from the city core with price tags too low to ignore blossomed during the housing boom. Homebuyers seeking that benchmark of the American dream were willing to make the long drive from their exurban homes to work. And they were even willing to take out mortgages they honestly couldn't afford. So now that credit has crunched and the housing boom is busted, more and more of these exurban residents have gone from homeowners to renters. According to the Wall Street Journal, this is bad news for many of these exurban locales, as it amounts to populations of people grasping to hold on to what they once had, but with struggling local economies that can't provide the services these residents need. Though there is some hope that the end of the recession will allow some of these renters to become homeowners once again, no one seems to be holding their breath for that day to come. And as budgets tighten, companies across the board are getting creative in an effort to lure customers. This sale mentality is even spreading to the world of infrastructure, where road contractors are heavily discounting construction bids to try to catch the eye of stimulus-funded states. The New York Times reports that road and bridge projects in Pennsylvania had received bids that were 15% lower than what state officials had expected. Contractors in Utah have even handed that state bids 25% less than the expected amount. It's a sign of bad times for the construction industry, which has been left with few building projects as the recession sets in. But the infusion of stimulus money directed at transportation projects has offered the industry a shining and highly demanded light. All this spells good news for states who can now get more work done for their dollar. So transportation projects are feeling the recession, and homeowners are definitely feeling the recession. The stimulus plan is providing some aid on both fronts, but it's not going to be enough, according to Robert Puentes of the Brookings Institution. He recently testified before Congress that the government needs to do more to link transportation and housing and land use decisions. The way they interact means problems on just one side unavoidably affect the other. Puentes says housing and transportation need to be considered interdependent entities. With the economy struggling and both sectors on shaky ground, now is the perfect time to radically rethink how we deal with them. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, what are the social and environmental problems with sprawl? We'll find out from John Norquist of the Congress for the New Urbanism. I'm Carol Coletta. With me is our producer, Scotty Iseri, and we're trying to encourage podcast listening.
We have a great podcasting audience. We have thousands of people that download our show every week. And we thought, since we have all these smart people that are sending us comments, maybe they'd like to talk to each other. So we have this social networking site called My City, and we'd like to invite you, the podcasting listener, to join us online.
It's so valuable to me, and not only in producing the show, but in doing the work I do at CEOs for Cities, to hear from people who are on the ground in cities all over the world, what's going right in those cities, what concerns them about their cities, how cities are meeting challenges in ways that are unexpected that more people need to know about. So I would love for people to get to know each other through My City, but I'd like to know what people are seeing in their cities that they think we ought to be aware of and what ought to be shared.
How selfish of you.
What can I say? But it is a great way for us to hear from listeners, and you can be so useful to us and to people all over the world who care about cities and care about making them better. So I hope you'll participate.
Shoot me an email, Scotty, Scotty, @smartcityradio.com. Scotty@smartcityradio.com, and I'll send you an invite. Join us online.
And we'll see you there. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The Congress for the New Urbanism is the leading organization promoting walkable communities worldwide. Since 1993, this group of architects, planners, developers, and engineers has worked to make connected communities in a smart regional context. My guest, John Norquist, is the former mayor of Milwaukee, and he's now the president and CEO of CNU. He joined us from his office in Chicago. John, what is new urbanism, and how does it differ from what we've classically known as urbanism, what Jane Jacobs wrote about many years ago?
Really, there isn't much different at all. Basically, the Congress for the New Urbanism advocates urbanism. I think the reason the word new got in there was in 1993 when we founded the organization. Urbanism was so stigmatized that there had to be some modifier on it. For it to have any kind of acceptance in the public realm. So we use the word new urbanism. Someday we'll probably get around to just saying Congress for urbanism.
And if you were to describe urbanism, how would you describe it?
Well, it's where you create places that are efficient, complex, streets and blocks and neighborhoods instead of freeways and subdivisions. Mixed-use zoning instead of separate-use zoning. Real communities, villages, cities, towns, instead of the sprawl that people have found to be unpleasant. So it's to advocate good urban form. And if you look at real estate prices and you look at performance in terms of energy and traffic distribution, the urban forms are what really work and add value.
The Congress was founded with a manifesto written in, as you say, 1993. Does that manifesto continue to serve the cause of new urbanism well? Have you ever felt the need to update it or alter it?
Well, a lot of it's pretty much timeless things. We founded the organization in 93, and the charter was actually adopted formally in 1996 at Charleston. We had a Congress with Henry Cisneros there and a lot of other people. He signed it. And the charter advocates the ingredients of urban form. It celebrates the complexity. It criticizes the social injustice that comes from sprawl, where you separate the poor from the wealthy and divide communities by subdivisions with just a certain kind of house, and then other places where there are apartments, everything separated. That sort of thing leads to all kinds of bad side effects. It's inefficient. It makes it harder for people to build community. It has social defects, which we're finding with health, with people living in neighborhoods where it's difficult, inconvenient to walk. You end up with child obesity and other problems like that. You know, the charter stood up pretty well, and there have been some efforts to change some of the words in it, but so far, despite vigorous debate, nothing's changed. Maybe we'll get a Bill of Rights or something someday that we'll attach to it.
we're obviously in a mess financially, and particularly with home mortgages and home ownership in this country. What does the notion of urbanism bring to this mess? Is there something that has gone astray that urbanism will help sort of get back in the road, so to speak? Or I'm just trying to think about ways in which the Congress for the New Urbanism has value to add to this, to getting us out of this mess.
If you look at demographics, if you look at consumer preferences right now, we're in the re-urbanization of America. Young people are much more attracted to urban living than previous generations. There's a lot more households that are single households or just two people that are more likely to live in apartments or condominiums. And so the urban form is a much bigger part of the real estate market. A guy at Brookings, Arthur Chris Nelson, did a study 2 years ago pointing out that in the next 30 years, we already have more detached single-family large lot housing in America than there's a market for over that period. So it's already built, and building more of it is not going to really provide something that has a lot of utility, whereas more urban forms are now doing better. I mean, nothing's doing well in this market, but the urbanism is hanging on to more value than the sprawl. And so that's an indicator of where the economy is going when we eventually come out of the recession. And it's important for builders, developers, designers to get with the program. I mean, if they want to make money and be successful in the marketplace that comes with the recovery, it's time to learn about urban form and urban techniques.
Do they, in fact, get it? Particularly developers, do you see any big movement, any widespread movement by developers and home builders to re-enter the city?
I do see it with developers. Home builders may be a little bit behind the curve. I think developers who have to assemble capital and then risk it, they're putting these projects together. They feel it. They know it. Big developers like Toll Brothers, they're changing their business to try to produce more urban product because they know they can't sell the other stuff. I think that the developers are actually getting it. And you can see it in other design issues. The modernists who created some beautiful buildings, I'm looking out my window right now at Mies van der Rohe's federal building with the Calder sculpture in front of it. You know, some beautiful modernist things, but there were some things that the modernists did that really were tough on cities. They really promoted this idea of separating the city into pods and having people drive more, and Corbusier in particular had the idea of killing the street. These ideas are hard to confront. I mean, they wanted to destroy the design world that existed before World War I, the Beaux-Arts, the City Beautiful movement in the United States with the beautiful avenues and the terminated vistas. They wanted to kill all that stuff, and I can understand why. I mean, the World War I was a terrible thing, and the architecture of the empire was like everything of the empires of Europe. It was something that was criticized because of the horror of the war. But the modernists were so thorough that they killed a lot of time-tested, thousands-of-year-old architectural techniques that were important to communities. One thing was the terminated vista. If you look down the LaSalle Street, for example, in Chicago, and you see the Chicago Board of Trade at the head of the street, in the period after World War II, where the modernists were dominant, that wasn't done anywhere in America for about 50 years. You can't even find examples. The only two examples I've found are in Anaheim and Orlando, and that's Disney World, where Main Street has Sleeping Beauty's castle at the end of Main Street. Other than that, you know, the modernists drove a lot of this stuff away, and just the whole idea of the street where you have sidewalks and transit and so forth, these are things that were being driven out of the design world. And we're trying to put those things back in, and the market is helping us a lot. And the developers are the ones that are really embracing the change. So actually, normally you'd think of developers, oh, they don't care about aesthetics, they just want to make money. But maybe it's because they want to make money. They're actually restoring the idea of terminated vistas, they're building main streets they're struggling at it. You know, not every one of them it really works. They keep getting better over time. But it's the developers, ironically, that are really leading the way out.
Well, this raises a question. Frequently, new urbanism is associated with a particular architectural style, not beyond planning, but architecture. Do you, in fact, believe that the Congress for the New Urbanism should be or is associated with a particular architectural style?
New urbanists don't say that, but sometimes our critics do, because the seaside, for example, is such a prominent, that's a resort community on the panhandle of Florida. And it was the first resort built in Florida for maybe 75 years that was built on blocks and streets instead of cul-de-sacs. And so it has urbanism, but it's still a resort, you know, and a resort is kind of an artificial place. It has a purpose, which is for people to go there and relax, you know, leave their law firm in Atlanta and go down to relax on the seashore in Florida. And the architecture of it is North Florida architecture with porches and the various features that buildings have. But the architecture of Seaside, ironically, even that includes modernist buildings, contemporary buildings, glass and steel. So there's no style requirement. What matters is the mass and scale and placement of the buildings. And a lot of new urbanists support very, very contemporary architecture. You can have the building styles of modernism are just fine. There's nothing wrong with them, and we're not against that.
New urbanism was born as a movement. Do you still think of it that way?
Absolutely. I mean, we have the basic ingredients of bad urbanism, of sprawl, of the things that we're trying to struggle against. They're still in place, but we're gradually winning some of these fights, but we need a movement to win. So, for example, the Clean Tea Bill, which is, I'll explain that acronym, there's something called ICET, the Federal Appropriation for Transportation. And Clean Tea is an agreed-upon bill that passes every couple of years where the Republicans and Democrats get together and agree on changes. And we were able to get the members of the committee, the four members of the committee, to put a network, street network proposal in as an alternative. Instead of just building road segments with federal money, instead to build networks of roads or to fund the rehabilitation and maintenance of networks of roads. Because every study that's ever been done on this that's serious shows that road networks are much better at distributing traffic than trying to put all the traffic in one giant freeway. And you can see how that works if you go to San Francisco, where they had the Embarcadero Freeway and the Central Artery Freeway, both of which were damaged by the earthquake in 1989 and removed. And then the streets were put back in that had been there before. The Embarcadero Freeway became the Embarcadero Boulevard. And the traffic distribution improved for most trips. The real estate values went way up. And the number of jobs and people living in the neighborhood went up because the views were restored of, for example, San Francisco Bay. And the whole thing worked a lot better. And so when you have that kind of model and you look at the facts, investing money in freeways is a big mistake. It might make sense between cities, but to do it within cities is a mistake because it degrades value and makes the traffic actually distribute poorly compared to the way it would with just the streets.
It's counterintuitive.
Absolutely. That's why it's so hard to explain.
Right. It's counterintuitive, and we've been doing it a different way and, you know, for many, many years. So the question becomes, how do you actually move that to adoption?
Well, engineers like forms to follow. They like to have procedures and forms in place, and then they can follow them. And if you look at what existed before, say, World War II, say back in the 1920s, if somebody had gone to Purdue University and studied civil engineering, they would have learned something called the two-rod street, which is the basic Midwestern downtown Main Street. 50 feet of pavement, 6.5-foot sidewalks on each side, two rods from the building line out to the median strip in the middle of the street, And this is just, if you look at the main streets around the Midwest, almost all of them are almost exactly that dimension, maybe with a variation here or there with the sidewalk size. And it's set up with the buildings built, you know, near the street. And it led to the street doing what streets have always done throughout human history, three things: movement, economics, and social culture. And that's what a good street does. And what the American public policy about streets has been for the last 50 years is just to convert it into just one thing, movement, and forget the other two things, the economics and the... So you couldn't... If you take a freeway, you can't put a coffee shop alongside the freeway. You have to go off on a ramp and go someplace else if you want that. But with a main street, you have all those ingredients together. And if you want to stroll down a street and see your friend or whatever, you can't do that on a freeway. So they've sort of dumbed down the purpose of the street just to one thing, the moving traffic. And that doesn't even do it very well at rush hour when you concentrate too much traffic in one street. So what we're talking about doing is restoring these forms that have worked well in the past, bring them back into the marketplace.
What are the most contentious issues within the movement today?
Well, we have debate within the movement between people who believe very strongly that zoning codes can really have a huge impact, and then we have other people who don't believe so strongly in that. There's a big following for the smart code, which is growing. It's becoming more like a consensus. But for a long time, we had people that were on one side of the smart code, which is a product that one of our members, Andres Duany, created. But the smart code has evolved. It has modules. It's almost like Wikipedia. It keeps changing based on people learning how to do things better. And so as each new module is added to the smart code, the original opponents of the smart code are starting to like it because they've had a hand in changing it. So that's an example. And it's kind of an inside ball game, but it was very intense for many years. And we still get, you know, we have a little bit of an argument once in a while with people that believe very strongly that transit is the key. And transit is very important. I think almost everybody would agree on that, except maybe the Heritage Foundation. But the question of how streets and transit interact, streets are important too. And so there are new urbanists, particularly among the traffic engineer types, who want CNU to focus on how streets work and try to come up with ways to improve streets and not just think about transit as the answer for everything. And so that debate goes back and forth, and sometimes people on one side will say, well, you don't care about transit, and the other say, well, you don't care about streets, and it goes back and forth. But ultimately, I think the best answer to that is the street networks that are assisted by transit, and you try to make everything work together. You need both, obviously, particularly like if you have streetcars, you need streets for the streetcar to be on.
Well, how about buses? It's hard to run buses without streets.
Absolutely, and buses have their place in the world of transportation.
Yeah, I think buses get a really bad rap. You and I have talked about that before. Buses are kind of nice to be able to jump on and off a bus.
Yeah, I mean, I ride the CTA a lot. I ride the L. I ride buses. You know, I use them both. You can't have a heavy rail facility on every block. Although, I guess, if you've been to Melbourne, Australia, they have streetcars that are just about everywhere. I think they're getting close to like 1,000 miles a streetcar in that city. So, I mean, it's just amazing. But anyway, I mean, you know, buses can be good. The one thing that buses run into is when they're in the mixed traffic with everything else, if you're a consumer, what's the advantage? And the advantage is you don't have to drive it. You don't have to park it, but on the other hand, it doesn't take you exactly where you want to go. And so you get into advantages if you're on a really good transit system, like, for example, the Washington Metro. If you want to get to a meeting from Reagan Airport to Capitol Hill, you can do that faster on the Metro than you can by cab. You can do it faster on the Metro than you can by anything except maybe helicopter. When transit service is really good, when it's really fast, and I think that's what attracts people to rail. But I think buses, you know, it doesn't take as much capital to put a bus line in. You just put it on the street. Buses are part of the system. And New York City has a lot of rail, but it has more bus movements and more bus riders than any transit system in America. So anybody that's in favor of buses should also be in favor of rail, and anybody who's in favor of rail should also be in favor of buses, because they really work together.
As a former mayor, you have a unique perspective on how new ideas and new ways of doing things get adopted at City Hall. A lot of people would like to understand the puzzle to that. Give me your perspective.
Well, I think the really important thing for a mayor to do is figure out how to add value to their city and to add value to the lives of the people in the city, and not get caught up in the kind of things that where conflict generates. Now, you have to get into conflicts. You can get into battles about how much public employees should be compensated, or, you know, whether or not the taxes should go up or not go up. But in general, if you look where the value is added, and when I was mayor of Milwaukee, one of the things that I found puzzling was why we weren't getting new development. It seemed like all the development was going on out in the suburbs. You know, I could blame it on the fact that we had poor people in the city, or I could have said, you know, the developers are a bunch of racists. You know, there are all kinds of things, negative arguments that you can make, which might have some truth in some cases. But what occurred to me finally was, well, what are we doing that's stopping development from happening? And we saw our development process, when we surveyed it, we found out it was taking way, way too long to get permits for good urban development, that our code was mangled with, it was like an old roof with patches on it from 30 years, and we needed to make our zoning code much better so that people could understand it and get permits quickly when they conformed to it. And so we did those things. And another thing we did which added value was we stopped trying to subsidize every project that came across the desk. This idea that people can't develop in cities without getting a taxpayer subsidy, that can really end up stigmatizing the city. You know, if the idea is that the city is so bad that the only way you can develop anything there is you have the taxpayers pay somebody to do it, that can really stigmatize your city. So we stopped subsidizing projects in the downtown and had some of our best years of infill development, new housing, et cetera, coming in after that point by speeding up the development process and not subsidizing projects. When you subsidize everything, also you get a lot of zoning attorneys, you get lobbyists, you get all the baggage hanging on the developer. If you just let the market take its course with a good zoning code, then the developer can spend the money on the project instead of lobbying the city council and the mayor.
John, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Hey, my pleasure.
John Norquist is the president and CEO of the Congress for the New Urbanism. He joined us from his office in downtown Chicago. Finally this week, when every day seems to reveal another layer of the current economic mess we're in, sometimes all you can do is shrug your shoulders. While our City Views commentator Walker Smith says, it's like a free ride when you've already paid.
In today's economic mess, irony is the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. My favorite so far is the headline above the fold on the front page of a recent edition of the Wall Street Journal. It turns out that the Dillon, South Carolina boyhood home of Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke was purchased recently at a foreclosure sale by a 27-year-old loan officer at the local First Citizens Bancorp branch. Now chew on that for a second and see if it doesn't taste a little ironic. Of course, it wasn't Bernanke's family that lost the family home to foreclosure. His parents sold the house in 1996 and moved to North Carolina to retire. The foreclosure occurred two owners later. Even so, the new owner certainly appreciates the connection, although not in this ironic way, for he is thinking of putting up a historical plaque to memorialize the tie to Bernanke. Now, of course, if one were to apply a strict definition of irony to this Wall Street Journal story, it wouldn't actually qualify as ironic. But there is still a certain sense of incongruity and wackiness in this story that is satisfying in much the same way as the true ironies in this financial mess. Several commentators have made a point of cataloging these ironies to entertain our collective sense of the absurd. It's instructive to lend an ear to some of these. For example, one popular irony that many have noted is that the very bankers and brokers and other financial wizards who now need huge infusions of tax dollars to bail them out are many of the same people who have gone to great lengths over the years to exploit every possible loophole to minimize their tax obligations. Other ironies would include that of outspoken free market advocates like Henry Paulson and George W. Bush pushing through government takeovers, partial or complete, of free market financial institutions. As the former head of trading and markets for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission put it, quote unquote, "the high irony is that the failure to regulate has led to a type of socialization." Another irony is that the U.S. is now forced to go hat in hand to many of the countries we used to give stern lectures to about their economic policies, a number of which have begun actively rethinking the commitments to free market principles that we extracted from them by twisting their arms until it hurt. And if these ironies strike you as too left-leaning, then let's balance the books here. George Will noted in a November 2008 column entitled, "You Guessed It, Irony Abounds," that the very financial storm that sealed an election victory for Barack Obama will saddle him with so much debt that his social agenda is likely to be derailed. In Will's words, quote unquote, "the conditions conducive to the election of liberals have put a polar frost on most such ambitions." Yes, irony is an equal opportunity mocker of everyone and everything caught up in this tangled mess. But maybe we'll luck out, and it won't turn out to be so tangled as a Gordian knot. After all, being ironic doesn't mean that these problems don't need solving. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. You can get more information about our guests and their work online. Go to smartcityradio.com to find the links to their work. You can also download past shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, and subscribe to our podcast. You can also get in touch with us, click on the contact button, or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com and let us know how we're doing. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. Who would have thought it figured? I'm Carol Coletta.